Okay, good morning everyone. If my voice goes a bit faint, raise your hand please. It's nice to see you. I've been asked to talk about models of production for food and agriculture. So it's a bit narrower, but nevertheless very important. And I do have to refer to the ISTD. Perhaps because the ISTD actually grew out of conversations between the World Bank and captains of the biotech industry and the agri-food industry. And closer to the conclusions of the ISTD, as you know, the biotech industry, Syngenta, etc., quit the ISTD report and disowned the report, and has ever since said this is not an objective scientific report. It was a process led by 400 scientists. The report was peer-reviewed twice, which is quite exceptional, and nevertheless the critiques of this report say it lacks scientific objectivity. This includes parts of DFID, the British government, and I think it's important to say this, and we may come back to that and things that might need to change. But indeed, the conclusions of this report were damning, you know, that the way we grow food has to change radically, that business as usual is no longer an option, and that, you know, all the indicators we have are turning negative fast and getting more and more severe, and more importantly, that the emerging context is beyond our human experience. It might have been part of the experience of the dinosaurs, but it was not our human experience. And the costs of the dealing with all these problems, remediation, mitigation, adaptation, are rising sharply. So there's an urgent need to rethink and transform production models. And I borrowed this from the permaculture school because they were talking about this many years ago. But the kinds of system shifts that we're talking about are illustrated in these pages. A shift from heavily energy intensive, resource intensive systems to models that mimic the functioning of nature. Systems that are much more elegant in terms of their energy use. To produce an industrial egg, we use something like 10 to 12 units of energy for one unit of egg, and we have completely more favorable ratios when you move to low external import or agroecologically based systems. Now, it's interesting that the ISTD advocates reducing the vulnerability of the global system by emphasizing locally based innovation and agroecological approaches. And when I talk about agroecology, I really want to distinguish it from the input substitution approaches which the corporate sector and some parts of the scientific establishment are latching on. It's basically approaches that leave the monoculture structure of the system intact and continue to provide goodies from the outside, usually very expensive, costly inputs such as botanical insecticides, Bacillus thuringiensis inputs that cost a lot and don't really reduce the cost price squeeze which farmers are experiencing. Agroecology is about redesigning systems in such a way that we mimic much, much more natural ecosystems. And these agricultural mimics rely on very complex knowledge of ecology, population biology, evolutionary biology. This is not small stuff. This is cutting-edge science of an order of much greater complexity than the genetic engineering science based on molecular biology and fairly simplistic reductionist models. And the beauty of much of the agroecological approach is that you can really design systems using assemblages of plants, animals, their diversity at a genetic, species, and ecological level to ward off pests, to increase yields, and to provide all kinds of ecological functions like pollination, etc. But more importantly, you can design liberatory technologies. By that I mean technologies which enhance the autonomy of farmers and land users by minimizing or even reducing their dependence on suppliers of off-farm inputs. Let's talk about technologies of liberation, technologies of autonomy. Now, of course, small farms around the world are still very rich in biodiversity, and they're often models of sustainability. Some use this diversity in an optimal way, others could do with a bit of help. And it's very interesting that in those cases where you've had a combination of farmers' experiential knowledge, building on their management systems, with agroecological knowledge, there have been huge increases in yields. In Africa, for example, 800 farm households that started using agroecological approaches to food production for major staples saw increases in yields of the order of 50 to 100%. And there's a lot of evidence for this from Brazil, from Asia, etc. Why is this important? Because small farms really represent the bulk of the farming population and the number of farms. 85% of the 500 odd million farms are below 2 hectares. So most of the farmers around the world are small farmers. And these are the places that harbor diversity, harbor knowledge that can be used in different ways to construct more resilient farming systems. And as people gather in Bangkok to talk about the problems, and as people are about to gather in Oxford to say that the climate change situation is worsening faster than they thought, I think it's good to remind ourselves that small farmers who use more organic practices actually fix an awful lot of carbon in the soil. You can fix enormous amounts of carbon by returning organic matter to the soil. And there's been an interesting estimate that if something like 10,000 small to medium-sized farms converted to organic farming, you'd basically be taking off the road something like 1 million cars. Now that's the potential, but it's interesting that this sort of contribution of small farmers to solving major problems is very much off the radar screen of a lot of decision makers, a lot of the international community. And I think one task is simply to raise the importance of these contributions to solving, in this instance, the climate change problem. When it comes to yield, it's good also to remember that many of these mixed farms, polycultures, agroforestry systems do yield more when you consider all the produce coming off a unit area of land than simply measuring the yield of a single crop. There's an inverse relationship between farm size and output, and that's due to a better use of solar energy, water, biodiversity, farm labor, etc. And maybe we should be thinking about putting much more emphasis on a small farm structure to feeding the planet in the future, rather than thinking big. Now, that invariably raises the question of the sceptics. Can agroecological approaches really feed the world? Now, it's interesting that there are a number of careful studies published in the literature which really suggest that there's a huge potential. Most notably, a recent study of the University of Michigan, a team of 10 scientists who looked at a range of case studies from the South, from the developing world and the developed world, and basically saying that an all-organic global food system could provide enough food for the world, including feeding 10 to 11 billion people by 2100. There's a myth that needs to be busted here, and that's part of the work of changing the rules. The myth is that small farmers and agroecological approaches cannot feed the world. Baloney. Now, I've been a little bit disturbed by the attention given to the farm per se, when clearly each link in the industrial food chain has huge ecological costs and social costs. And my feeling is that changing models of production per se, agricultural production per se, is not enough. We've really got to think much more about how do we radically transform the entire food system and its support infrastructure. The energy systems, the waste management systems, the water supply systems in which food systems are embedded. And I think we need to think much more comprehensively. I had some nice diagrams there, but they haven't appeared. And here, as we think about the different links of the food system from seed to plate, not just the farm bit in the middle, but everything that happens upstream and downstream, there's a huge challenge, which is technological, institutional, and to do with our imagination, of moving away from what's essentially a linear throughput system to a much more circular system that connects different parts of the landscape together: energy provision, food production, waste management, water management, etc. And key words here are notions like agroecology when you talk about the farm itself, and that combination of the experiential knowledge of farmers and modern science, but also notions of eco-literacy and eco-designs, notions of biomimicry, permaculture and holistic design and management, and models of circular economy. It's interesting that the government of China actually has a policy encouraging circularity in agriculture. That's to say, an agriculture that changes, that closes nutrient loops, and not just on the level of a neighborhood or a village, but indeed on the level of the whole province. And these are the kinds of institutional innovations and mind flips that I think are needed. I note simply that there's not much movement on this, neither within the food sovereignty movement, nor in much of academia. And there's a challenge here for transforming knowledge that reintegrates different areas of life in ways that reduce ecological footprints and enhance people's autonomy and freedom. And that brings me on to the final point. I've been very techie here, but I wouldn't like you to go away thinking this is very technology driven. For me, technology is underpinned by certain social relations and power relations, and I think it's very important that we be always conscious about the kinds of social relations and power relations which particular technological trajectories lead to. And basically, we do have questions in our big vision about what we want as citizens: more uniformity, centralization, coercion, and loss of mean and alienation, or technological trajectory, models of production for food and agriculture that celebrate diversity, build on decentralization, democracy and freedom. These are real political questions that have to be at the forefront of whatever map we chart for the future. They're not taboo questions, they are questions of citizens. So in the small group discussion, I'd like to focus on some of the things that might need to change a bit more to make this happen, this shift happen. The whole area of transforming food and agricultural research, I mean, it's obvious, present food and agricultural research is not delivering sustainability, resilience, equity. It needs to be fundamentally transformed in terms of its concept, its theories, and ways of working of scientists. Huge agenda. Policy reforms. If we're talking about bringing biodiversity back from seed to plate, obviously IPR laws are out of sync. If you want to build resilient food systems in the face of climate change, forget about policies that favour uniformity, standardisation of parts. You need diversity to deal with the fluctuations in the climate. But there may be other policy reforms that we can talk about. Food laws, for example. Food and safety laws. Market and trade rules, we've heard a lot about it. Question for me is reform or revolution here? How audacious are we going to be? And then, how do we make citizens' voices really count in writing the rules? What's it going to take? I mean, what will it take in this country to get DFID to acknowledge the ISTD when the government itself has signed rather reluctantly to the ISTD report? But the new plans for DFID's investment in foreign aid are very much business as usual when it comes to food and agriculture. Now, this is British taxpayers' money. What do we do about it? This is on our doorstep. So these are some of the things we could discuss this afternoon. I'll be your moderator along with Barnaby Peacock, and look forward to seeing you there. Thank you.
Thank you very much.